You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. 14 lectures given in various cities between January and December 1912, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 1, given in Munich on the 11th of January, 1912, entitled Nervousness and Ego Development. In the context of much of what we already know, which may still be useful to some of us, a stimulus will today be given which could lead to a more focused way of observing the nature of human beings and its connection with the world. Anthroposophists will have ample opportunity, aside from the usual riposts and objections to spiritual science encountered in recent public lectures, to encounter what those outside anthroposophy often assert. Ever and again we face objections from both learned and untutored people when in spiritual science we speak of a stratification of the whole human being into the four elements we always cite: a physical body, an ether, etheric, or life body, an astral body, and an I, or ego. Skeptics might object that for someone in whom certain usually concealed soul forces have been developed, it might be possible to discern something of this fourfold nature. But for someone not able to see such an organism, there would be scant grounds for surrendering to any such view. Now, it must be emphasized that human life, observed attentively, not only confirms what spiritual science has to say, but rather that when what can be learned from spiritual science is applied in practical life, it turns out to be exceptionally useful. You will discover that these uses, I don't mean uses in their base sense, but benefits in a more elevated sense, will eventually confer on us a sort of confidence, even if we do not want to commit to what clairvoyant observation offers. It is only too well known that nowadays people complain at length about what is implied in those much feared words, nervousness or anxiety. We need not be surprised that some feel compelled to claim that nowadays there is hardly anyone who is not to some extent nervous. Why would we not find such a statement plausible? Regardless of social relations and conditions to which causes of nervousness could be ascribed, conditions described collectively as nervousness simply exist, and they manifest in the most diverse ways. At their simplest and least uncomfortable, we might call such people soul fidgeters or soul fretters. They can be described as unable to hold onto a thought properly, nor to follow it to its conclusion, who continually jump from thought to thought, and if one tries to anchor them to a single thought, have already leapt onto another. A certain haste in their soul life is often the mildest form of nervousness. Another type of nervousness is one whereby the person hardly knows how, of themselves, to initiate action, or in relation to things they need to resolve, are unable to make progress, and actually never quite know what they should do in a given situation. This can, in turn, lead to other more serious conditions, where nervousness leads increasingly to other forms of illness, for which no organic cause can be found, but which speciously mimic organic pathologies, such that one might believe a person was suffering from a severe stomach complaint, when in fact they have nothing more serious than what can be summed up under the minor heading of nervousness. They are, of course, symptoms under which the person concerned suffers, just as much as if the illness originated from an organic source. Numerous other conditions could be mentioned, and who has not experienced examples of this through their own suffering or that of those in their environs. One doesn't need to go far. I am not about to digress onto other subjects. In order to speak of the momentous events of outer life as, in quotes, political alcoholism, something recently couched in terms of anxiety-ridden happenings in public life and which manifest as if driven by the sort of conduct usually only seen when an individual is slightly affected by alcoholism. The term is apt for the ways and means by which political affairs have been conducted in recent months in Europe. Here in external life you see not only such manifest nervousness, but also that it is experienced as highly distressing. Such nervous anxiety is perceptible on every hand. What has just been described will certainly not improve for people in the near future, but will become ever more acute. Auspicious prospects for humanity's future are not warranted if people remain as they are today. Because there are many pernicious influences affecting our lives to an exceptional degree, and transferred from person to person in a way I have to call epidemically, result in affecting not only those who are predisposed, but also those who are fundamentally healthy, if perhaps somewhat weak. Something incredibly detrimental for our times is that a large number of those attaining leading positions in public life have studied in the way presently favored. There are whole branches of scholarship nowadays, of which it can be said that one's year-round university life is spent following pursuits other than those demanding thorough deliberation and perusal of what college professors have to say. One goes in now and then, but whatever needs to be known for passing exams can be acquired in a couple of weeks. In other words, one crams the bare necessities. The worst aspect of this is the cramming itself. Because to some extent this attitude to study reaches back into lower schools, the damaging results are not inconsiderable. The main trouble with cramming is that any real connection between soul interest, that innermost core of a person's being, and the matter being swatted is not present. Even among pupils in schools, the prevalent opinion is, oh well, no matter if what I learn is soon forgotten, so that the passionate longing to retain what one has learned is absent. A lean band of interest links the core of the human soul with whatever it is embracing. As a direct consequence of this fact, human beings cannot develop themselves sufficiently to engage in public life with much effectiveness. This outcome of cramming what they should have embraced results in finding no connection with the tasks of their profession. In soul, they remain remote from what they have been pursuing with their heads. There is hardly anything worse for the essential being of humankind than remaining remote in heart and soul from what one has to carry out with one's head. This is not only inconsistent for more sensitive souls, but is something that greatly undermines the strength and energy of ether bodies, specifically the human ether body. Ether or life bodies become ever weaker under such driven conditions due to the meager bond existing between the core of the human soul and what it carries out. The more a person has to perform actions in which they have no interest, the more do they weaken their ether or life body. Anthroposophy is intended to work upon those who assimilate anthroposophy healthily, in such a way that they not only learn about a human being consisting of physical body, ether body, and so on, but that these four elements in human nature can evolve strongly and vigorously. If a person carries out a simple experiment, but repeats it diligently, this trifle can work wonders. Forgive me if I talk about isolated observations, about details that are and can become meaningful for human life. The occasional slight forgetfulness shown by some people relates closely to what I have just characterized. Slight forgetfulness disturbs us. Yet anthroposophy can show how this forgetfulness is most extremely harmful to health. However odd this may sound, it is true. Many outbreaks within the human constitution, bordering on the further reaches of pathology, could be avoided were human beings less forgetful. Now you could object that people just are forgetful. Who can, and we can easily clarify this with an overview of life, who can totally absolve themselves of forgetfulness? Let us take a frequent yet trivial example. People catch themselves being forgetful, never remembering where they have put objects they need. Isn't this what often happens in life? One person can never find his pencil, another always misplaces his cufflinks in the evening, and so on. It may seem banal and trifling to talk about such things, yet they happen in life. Observing what can be learned from anthroposophy, there is a good exercise relating to the matter in hand, namely, that the kind of forgetfulness just characterized can be remedied very easily. Let us assume a lady puts her brooch or a gentleman his cufflinks somewhere, and they find next morning that they cannot locate them. Now, you could certainly maintain that they could get used to putting them in the same place every day. One couldn't do this for every single item, but let's not talk about this right now, but rather about a more effective method of curing oneself. Let's assume a person who had noticed their absent-mindedness might say, "I am going to put that item I need to find in various places. I will never put that object in places other than the one about which I have generated the thought. I place this item in this specific place. I note pictorially the environs in terms of shape, color, and so on, and I try to allow all this to imprint itself upon me." Let's say we place a safety pin on the corner of a table, just at an angle, accompanied by the thought, "I am putting this on the edge, and I imprint on my mind, in pictorial form, the right-angled corner, and the way the safety pin is near two intersecting edges," and so on. Relieved, I now leave the item. I will see, maybe not if I find the item once, but if I make a rule of linking such thoughts with the item over time, that my forgetfulness will gradually diminish. This is based on the fact that a quite specific thought has been grasped, namely, I am putting the safety pin here. My I, capital, is brought into connection with the action, with what I am carrying out, to which is added a pictorial image. Clear imagery in thinking, visually imagining what I am doing, in addition to associating my action with my soul's spiritual essence, with the core of my being, with my I. This is what can sharpen our memory quite significantly. This is how becoming less forgetful can benefit our lives. You need not worry that you are achieving only this aim, because far more is gained through it. Let's assume that it had become a sort of customary habit for people to foster such thoughts when putting certain items down. This simple habit would generate a strengthening of human ether bodies. Through doing this, the human ether body is ever more consolidated, becomes ever stronger and stronger. We have learned from anthroposophy that the ether or life body serves in a certain way as the bearer of memory. If we do something that fortifies our forces of memory, we can immediately understand that strengthening our memory is going to be of benefit to our ether or life body. As anthroposophists, we need not be surprised by this. Imagine that you would not only recommend this method to a forgetful person, but to someone exhibiting symptoms of a nervous condition. Imagine you would advise a fidgety or nervous person to carry out the exercise of placing articles and accompanying this action with thoughts in the way described. You would notice that not only do they become less forgetful through intently practicing this exercise, but by strengthening their ether body, they gradually become capable of overcoming their nervous or anxious condition. Here, everyday life provides us with proof that what anthroposophy says about the ether body is true. When we relate appropriately to the ether body, it becomes apparent that it gains forces, gains strength. In achieving such successes, we are provided with proof that accepting the ether body as characterized is justified. Let us move on to another subject, which again appears minor, but which is extraordinarily important. You know that the elements with which we are familiar as the physical and ether bodies exist in immediate proximity to each other in the human being. The ether body is intimately embedded in the physical body, that is, these two bodies interpenetrate one another. Nowadays, you can observe an idiosyncrasy, which is far from rare, and about whose existence those in whom it is observed can do nothing. In observing this, while having a healthily compassionate soul in our breast, we will feel sorry for those observed to have this condition. Have you ever noticed in officials at a post office counter or others who write a great deal with pens, how they make peculiar movements before setting pen to paper? They create a sort of run-up in the air with their pens before starting to write. Though it may not actually transpire, it indicates a tendency to a worse condition when people do things like this in their profession. It might stay at this stage, you can observe it yourself, that when people write, they first have to give themselves a certain shove for each stroke, or they may write in jerky bursts instead of flowing evenly up and down. You can see it in handwriting written like this. A condition such as this can be understood in terms of spiritual scientific knowledge as follows. In completely healthy human beings, healthy as far as their physical and etheric bodies are concerned, the ether body, which is directed by the astral body, needs to be totally capable of acting on the physical body. The physical body, in turn, has in every one of its movements to be capable of serving as the tool of the ether body. If the physical body produces movements of its own accord that go beyond what the soul can intend, what the astral and ether bodies intend, this is an unhealthy state, and a predominance of physical body over ether body is evident. In all those having the condition described, we are dealing with a weakness of the ether body, which manifests in its inability to fully direct its physical body. A relationship between the etheric and physical bodies of this kind underlies, from an occult perspective, all cramp-like, convulsive conditions. This is the fundamental connection between an ether body exercising less command over its physical body than it should, allowing the latter to dominate and make all sorts of involuntary movements, whereas the movements of a healthy person are subservient to the intentions of their ether and astral bodies. There is an opportunity to help such a person if their condition is not too entrenched. However, the spiritual facts have to be taken into account, and this includes strengthening the ether body itself. This involves, to some extent, believing that the ether body exists and that it is capable of being strengthened. Imagine the poor person who is in such a bad way that his fingers incessantly fidget before writing a single letter. It will always be beneficent to advise they go on holiday, have a break from writing so much, and their nervous tics will vanish. But this is only half the story. Much more could be achieved by adding another second element to this advice, such as make the effort, without overexerting yourself, 15 to 30 minutes suffice, to adopt a different script. Change your handwriting, so that you are obliged to abandon your mechanical way of writing, and instead pay attention to how you shape each letter. Let's say you write an F like this. Now, try to make it different, more sharply slanting, so that you have to take more notice. Get used to carefully drawing each letter. Were spiritual knowledge to be more widespread, managers would not, when someone afflicted returned from leave, say, "You crazy individual, you've changed your handwriting. It's completely different." An anthroposophist employer would understand that this is a significant remedy. By changing their handwriting, a person is forced to direct their attention to what they are doing. Deploying attentive focus onto what we are doing always involves bringing our innermost core into close congruence with our actions. Everything that unites the inner core of our being with our deeds reinforces our ether or life body, and we become healthier as human beings. It would not be in the least foolish to work towards strengthening ether bodies throughout education and in schools while pupils are still young. This is where anthroposophy should be putting forward proposals, which will not be taken up in practice because anthroposophy has long been regarded by those at the forefront of controlling education as something harebrained. But no matter. Imagine, when teaching children to write, that they would initially be taught a certain style. One would wait a couple of years and see to it that they changed their writing without inducement. A change in writing of this kind, and its attendant increase in attentiveness, would have an enormously strengthening effect on their developing ether bodies. In later life, these young people will suffer from fewer nervous conditions. So you see, throughout life, we are always capable of doing something to fortify our etheric or life body. And this is exceptionally important because it is precisely such weaknesses in the etheric or life body that attract countless harmful conditions today. It can even be said, and it is actually not said often enough, that certain forms of illness, which may be based on things against which seemingly not much can be done, would, with a strong ether body, take quite a different turn from that taken by the weakened ether bodies so characteristic of present human beings. Here we have indicated something we can call conditioning the etheric or life body. We implement certain exercises to strengthen the ether body. No such exercises can be brought to bear on something we deny or claim is not there. By showing that it benefits our ether body when we carry out certain exercises and can demonstrate their effectiveness, we prove that an ether body exists and is present. Everywhere, life provides the corresponding evidence for what anthroposophy has to offer. Our ether bodies can grow stronger if we do something else to improve our memory, something referred to in another context, but which will be repeated here because, for all illnesses in which nervousness plays a part, one ought to be able to resort to such advice. One can strengthen one's ether or life body enormously by mentally running through things one knows, not just in the way one usually thinks of them, but by running through them in reverse order. Let us say, for example, that at school one is required to memorize a sequence of dates, of battles, of rulers, with their corresponding years. It is extremely good not just to learn them in their conventional neat sequence, but to assimilate them in the opposite order by going through everything from end to beginning. This is exceptionally important, because when we do this comprehensively, we are contributing enormously to increasing the vitality of our ether body. Thinking through whole dramas from end to beginning, or recalling in reverse stories we have read, these activities are of the highest importance for consolidating the ether body. Today you can experience how almost everything known to be effective in strengthening our ether bodies is not in fact carried out, either with requisite regularity or indeed at all. There is little opportunity in today's restless daily busyness to create the inner quietude needed to tend such practices. Most working people are usually too tired by evening, too harassed to think about where they are placing their things or with what deliberation they are doing so. If, however, spiritual science were to really permeate hearts and souls, it would become evident that much of what goes on in today's world could be avoided, and that the time spent on these strengthening exercises would be abundantly rewarding for each person. Remarkably beneficial results would soon become apparent, especially when care is taken of this advice in education. Let me mention another detail, one which may be of slightly less benefit in later life, but which is nevertheless worthwhile, especially if it has not been tended in their youth. That is, that we immediately review what we have done or accomplished, regardless of whether it does or does not leave a trace. This is relatively easy with handwriting. I am sure that many would drop their ugly writing habits were they to try and review letter for letter, as their glance swept over it once again, the manner in which it had been written. Reviewing one's handwriting contemporaneously, evaluating what one has done, in this way is relatively easy. Yet there is another sound practice, albeit one that ought not to be practiced for long, that involves watching yourself while walking, how your hands move, how you tilt your head, the way you laugh, taking conscious pictorial account of your gestures. You will see from observing life how few people are aware of their gait, how few can visualize what they look like when walking. But it is useful to gain an impression of the results of one's deeds, though, as I said, it must be a short-lived exercise if it is not to contribute too greatly to vanity. Apart from the fact that we will certainly correct several aspects of ourselves in life, this task is of enormous positive value in consolidating the ether or life body, and also in enhancing the astral body's control of it. In observing their movements, in watching what they do while making imaginative images of this, people can succeed in increasing the benefit they gain from their astral body being in ever stronger control of their ether body. In this way, they can be in a position deliberately to suppress, change, or eliminate, when necessary, some trait or modus operandi that lies within their habits. It is among the greatest achievements of human beings, in some circumstances, to vary the way they do things. It is certainly not the aim here to found some sort of school of handwriting conversion. People usually only contort the strokes of their writing in aid of some wrongdoing. Yet it is helpful with honest intent in fortifying one's ether body to consciously vary the way one forms one's script. It is entirely healthy to be able to bring variety to the way in which one carries out something one intends to do, instead of being compelled to do it only in one way. Similarly, while nobody needs to become fanatically ambidextrous, using left and right hands with identical facility, it is, nevertheless, valuable to try to do at least certain jobs with a measure of fluency in both hands, perhaps using your left hand instead of the usual right hand, and again not being reliant on one single method. This need not be continued beyond a basic ability, yet it will have a most positive effect on the astral body, being able to take charge of the ether body as it should. Fortifying human beings in the sense described through spiritual science is something that needs to be brought into our culture through the dissemination of anthroposophy. What one can call a culture of will is of great concern. It has already been pointed out that nervous anxiety may often manifest precisely in modern people not knowing how to start doing what they really intend to do. They are frightened of carrying out their intentions. They simply do not manage to do things. What can be summarized as a certain weakness of will is caused by the diminished ability of their I, capital, to take proper control of its astral body. Insufficient control of an astral body by an ego is always symptomatic of people wanting something, or perhaps not wanting something, or at least not getting around to carrying out their intention. Some cannot even muster a serious enough will to will what they should be willing. Now, there is a simple means of strengthening your will for your daily life. This remedy is to suppress wishes you harbor, precisely not to carry out their fulfillment, and obviously not to do this were such non-action to cause harm. If you check yourself all day long in daily life, you will notice countless things for which you wish, and whose fulfillment would be very nice. Yet you will find just as many wishes, whose fulfillment you can afford to relinquish without detriment to yourself or anyone else, without reneging on a duty, wishes which might have brought you joy, but which can just as well remain unimplemented. If you proceed systematically in suppressing, among other wishes, those of which you can say, no, that wish can remain unsatisfied. This means avoiding those wishes that could cause harm, and only those that give delight, joy, and contentment. Then each denial of some small desire will contribute to an influx of willpower, to an empowering of your I, capital, over your astral body. We would to some extent be able to catch up with such a process of self-education in later years, a practice which is largely neglected in the education of children nowadays. It is basically difficult to work therapeutically in education in the area just characterized. One has to take into account that if, in a teaching situation, one is in a position to grant a child or young person's wish, and one then denies it, one not only denies the wish, but a certain antipathy can be elicited. Educationally, this can be upsetting. Some might say there is a dubious aspect to wish denial, if antipathy is the result. Here you are on something of a cliff edge. If a father wants to educate his son by saying, "No, Charles, you are not having this," the result may well be that the antipathy then calls forth toward his father is worse than the desired effect of being denied a wish. You may ask, what should one do here? There is a very simple remedy. You do not deny the child their wishes, but instead deny yourself, so that the child becomes aware that you are foregoing something. In the first 7 years, and also later in life as an after effect, children have a strong urge to imitate, and we will see that when we firmly deny ourselves this or that in the presence of children we are to educate, that they will imitate it, and however unconsciously, perceive it as an aim worth pursuing. In this way we will have achieved something of enormous significance. Here we see how our thoughts just need to be directed and guided in the right way, through all that spiritual science can offer. Then spiritual science will not just remain a theory, but will become life's wisdom, something that can really support and guide us throughout life. The two public lectures I have held here present a means by which much can be learned about the I controlling the astral body. A unique feature of these lectures was that arguments both for and against were postulated. If you now examine, on a soul level, how people relate to life, you will notice that their thoughts and actions usually settle upon what can be said either for or against any matter. This is the norm. But in life there is no single subject about which there can be an absolute for or against, not one. In every case there is both a pro and a con. We will do well in every case to become accustomed to taking account not only of one but of both sides, weighing up not only arguments for nor indeed against, but considering both the pros and the cons. In whatever way we do it is valuable to establish for ourselves why and under which circumstances we would do better to refrain from a particular action, or at least be aware that there are also good reasons against such a course. Vanity and egotism often tend to speak against laying out counter-arguments that go against doing what one wants to do, because far too often people just want to be good people. One can find proof of being a good person if one only does what is applauded, yet refrains from doing what contradicts this. It is slightly uncomfortable that one can find objections to almost everything one does in life. I say this because it is extremely important for life. We are not nearly as good as we believe ourselves to be. In every single thing we do, even when we do it because life demands it of us, this general truth only becomes useful to the extent that we also rehearse what would lead to us refraining from doing it. What can be achieved through this becomes evident when bringing before our souls the following simple example. You will certainly have met people who are so weak in will that they can barely resolve to do anything, preferring others to make decisions for them, which they only need to carry out. They shrug off responsibility, preferring to ask what they should do rather than weighing up reasons for this or that course of action. I am not just bringing this example for its own sake, but to achieve something else. Whilst much can be said in support of what I have just said, objections can also be raised against it. In fact, one can barely say anything in life against which, in certain senses, no objection can be brought. So, let us take the person who is fond of asking others for instructions. Standing opposite each other are two people, both offering advice on the same subject. One says, "Yes, do it." The other says, "No, don't do it." You will see that in life, one of these advisers decisively gains the upper hand over the other. The opinion of the one with the strongest will is victorious in influencing the questioner. What phenomenon have we here? However inconsequential it looks, it is a very significant phenomenon. If I face two people and one says yes, the other no, and I carry out the yes, the willpower of that advisor works on in me, gaining such predominance that it empowers my deed. Their power of will has triumphed over that of the other advisor. The will of another person has won within me. Assume for a moment that I do not now face two other people, each of whom advises yes and no, respectively, but that I am quite alone, and in my own heart lay out the yes and no, complete with their reasons, so that nobody helps me. I do this alone. No other person approaches me as I weigh up the rationale for and against. Then I carry out the yes, in that I have said to myself, "This has unfurled a strong force, but this time within myself. What another person previously enacted through me, I now carry out myself, thereby nurturing a force in my soul." So that when inwardly faced with a choice, a strength has prevailed over a weakness. This is immensely valuable, because it restores the sovereignty of your I over your astral body, re-empowering it enormously. Checking the reasons for and against, in all possible detail, is not something one should view as an inconvenience. You will discover just how much this does to strengthen your will if you try to carry out what has been typified here. However, this can also have its shadow aspect, namely that instead of strengthening will, a weakening could occur. If, after having examined the rationale of for or against, and resolved upon the one or the other course, one fails, out of sheer slackness, to do anything at all, taking neither choice, this looks as if a choice of against has been taken, yet one is actually plain lazy. It is therefore preferable, if taking spiritual science into account to any extent, that you do not attempt any such reasoning when you are tired, leaving decisions to a time when you are not exhausted, but feel strong enough and know that you are no longer worn out, and can really act upon the choice you have put to your soul. You have to pay attention to the time at which you pose such soul questions. Among further things that contribute powerfully to strengthening one's eye over the astral body is this: that we put aside everything that creates a polarity between us and the rest of the world, between us and our surroundings. This ought to belong to the basic obligations we place upon ourselves as anthroposophists. Justified criticism is unavoidable, for if it is factually objective, it would be a weakness to substitute bad for good, something one can never do. But we have to learn to differentiate between what we ourselves criticize and things whose influence on our personality is just uncomfortable and annoying. The more we can make a habit of ensuring that our judgment of others is independent of their behavior toward us, the more we can do this, the better it is with regard to fortifying our eyes' sway over our astral body. Not by way of self-congratulation, saying, "You are a good person because you don't criticize your fellow human beings," but in order to reinforce your eye. To this end, it is constructive not only to refrain from judging as bad such things as you dislike because they make you feel uncomfortable, but rather, especially where appraisal of people is concerned, only to voice opinion when you yourself are not under consideration. As a theory, this is easy to embrace, but exceptionally difficult to practice in real life. It is good when, for example, someone has lied to you, to suspend your antipathy toward them. This is no case for recounting to others that the person has lied to you, but rather that your feeling of antipathy is withheld. Whatever we notice about a person, how consistently they conduct their affairs on any given day, can all help to form an impression of the person in question. Whenever someone speaks, sometimes like this, sometimes differently, we need only compare what they themselves say to arrive at quite a different basis for our opinion of them than just one that emphasizes their attitude toward us. It is vital to let things speak for themselves, not judging a person on each single deed, but rather on how their actions chime together as a whole. You will soon find, even in those you held to be hard-bitten detractors, who cause nothing but ill, that there is much that contradicts their usual behavior. We do not need to focus on their conduct toward us at all. We can ignore ourselves, placing the person within their own behavior in our mind's eye, EYE, and, where necessary, coming to a view about them. In aid of strengthening the ego, it is also good to ponder that the majority, 9/10, of the opinions we form can readily be abandoned. Experiencing within one's own soul just 1/10 of the opinions we form about the world is more than enough for one lifetime. Our life of soul will in no way be disadvantaged by relinquishing the remaining 9/10 of our opinions. Today I have brought what may seem like trifles, but now and again it must be our responsibility to look at things such as these. Precisely in this way can we demonstrate how small things can have mighty effects, how we need to grasp life from the completely opposite end, as it were, if we wish to structure the sheaths of our bodies strongly and healthily, differently from the way life is habitually grasped. It is not invariably right to send someone to the chemist for the right medicine when they are ill. The right thing will be to organize one's life in such a way that one is less susceptible to illness, or that those illnesses are less severe. It will be less onerous if a person carries out such exercises as strengthen the influence of their eye, capital, over their astral body over their ether body, and the influence of this in turn on their physical body. Self-discipline and its impact on development are themes that can proceed from the fundamental ethos of anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 1.